Esther is the, I don't know the right word for this, the pagan version of Hadassah, the Hebrew. Hadassah is the name of Esther in Hebrew. And it's mentioned that. The interesting thing is the book is called Esther, and she's called Esther through the book, the Babylonian, the Chaldean form of it, just the same way that Daniel's friends, when they were in captivity, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the Bible refers to them in their Chaldean forms, not necessarily always, or does it first, but then it switches to Chaldean forms in their Hebrew name. Same thing. This is a Babylonian, a Chaldean book. This is written in that time frame. This is written with that perspective. And so the names of the Jews in the ones that are changed or in their forms are going to be given in that form, the Chaldean form. So this is the book. The title is Esther, Hadassah. It's about her, sort of. The timing of this book. The timing of this book is interesting. So 50 years, approximately, all times in Bible situations are approximates. Approximately 50 years before the events in the book of Esther, Zerubbabel returns from captivity in Babylon. So this is the captivity period. This is after the kings of Judah and Israel. This is when they've gone into captivity, Babylonian captivity, at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, and so on. So 50 years after, or prior to the book of Esther, Zerubbabel has returned from the decree of Cyrus to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. So, about 30 years prior to this book of Esther, the temple is completed. It's about 20 years building time frame of the temple. About 30 years prior, the temple is complete. Esther takes place, the story of Esther takes place during or right after approximately, if you go and you read histories, you'll find a little bit of contradiction in the exact timings of all this. But approximately the time of the second wave of refugees returning back to Jerusalem. During the time of Nehemiah, the building of the walls. So the temple was built first in the return, and then the city was built second. So this is what's going on back in Babylon when most of Israel, most of the Jews are returning to Jerusalem, to Israel. It is, and I want to be very careful with the book of Esther, because people have, it's amazing to me. Look at Bible study on Esther, and you will find far more assumptions, and from that, attempts at application, than you will find facts about the book. I one time heard an entire sermon preached on the person Vashti in the book of Esther, who is mentioned just briefly, and it's really just to set the stage of the book. She's not presented as a moral or immoral character. She's just presented as a character because it helps us understand what happens. But people like to, sometimes they like the less information, the more they like to preach sermons on it, it seems like sometimes. So you'll find a lot out there about Esther, but the reality is it's a bit of an enigmatic book. We don't have a lot of information about what's going on. The people involved, Esther, Mordecai, Haman, Vashti, these people, aside from King Xerxes, or as he's called here, Ahasuerus, aside from him, these people are really not found in any other historical documents. That's not to doubt their existence, because I wouldn't be found in any historical documents. The reality is that these are just not, personally speaking, important individuals in history. They're just in the history of things, in the history of Babylon, or this is the Persian king, but the captivity began with the Babylonians. Not in the history of the Persians, aside from Xerxes. Not in the history of the Israelites. It's just really not. It's not like the you have David in here or somebody like that. So it's a very enigmatic book with interesting people that we really know very little about. But the timeline we can place right at that second return from a captivity. Contemporaries, just to kind of set a world stage, contemporaries. What was going on in the world? Who was around in the world when the book of Esther takes place, the events in the Esther takes place? Well, first of all, Socrates was alive, the philosopher. Herodotus, the historian, he was alive and active. These are both Greco-Roman type of Socrates, a Greek. Herodotus, I believe, was he Greek? He's Greek, okay. Confucius was over in the China area. He was alive. And Cambyses, I don't know if he's probably the least familiar to all of us, but Cambyses was a well-known Egyptian ruler. So these are individuals. So this is what's going on in the world. So just think of the time frame. This is the time frame of Esther, 486 to 465 BC. So approximately 500 years before Christ. So you get the idea of what is going on here. This is the time frame of when this takes place. Xerxes is likely the Persian king here. He's called Ahasuerus. I don't know. I've done as much research as I have the time for, but Ahasuerus seems to be a biblical way of describing different kings, not the same guy. So you'll find an Ahasuerus in Daniel. You find Ahasuerus here. But those, our time frame is very different. It can't be the same individual. And so that kind of can present some confusion. But the reality is, it seems like, from my understanding, Ahasuerus may be actually just a Jewish way of writing about foreign kings. This is most likely Xerxes I, whose son was Artaxerxes, kind of a well-known king. Xerxes may come across when you first read the story of Esther of like this kind of, because he's really presented in a very negative light, not so much an immoral light, but as an incompetent light in the book of Esther. He's always drinking. He's always drunk. In fact, one of the things that's constantly, when the banquets, talk about the banquets, it makes it very clear in the scripture, they call it a banquet of wine. And they call it that several times. The banquet of wine. And when they met at the banquet of wine, and Xerxes is kind of presented this way of kind of like this drunk king who constantly makes bad decisions in his drunkenness. It's kind of the way he's described here. And you might get the idea from that Xerxes is kind of like this picture of this like old guy sitting around this old king. But actually, he was assassinated at the age of 36. And so he's young. He's not an old individual here, which that may be connected with the banquet of wine too. I'm not sure, but the idea that he is young. He was part of some of the most famous battles in Grecian history. The Greco-Persian, he's a Persian, but the Grecian history kind of has more about this, but the Greco-Persian, the Greece-Persian wars. And one particular battle is probably one of the most famous battles of all those, the Battle of Thermopylae. Xerxes was on the Persian side of that Battle of Thermopylae. He was the king. So he actually, some believe this is set right when he returns from a great victory. Some think that's when this takes place, and which is why the big banquets of wine, celebration sort of thing. Okay, so you got the setting. About 12 years elapses in the book, give or take. About 12 years takes place here. So we read it in 10 chapters very quickly, but this time does pass here, which this isn't unusual to Bible accounts, is it? I mean, we see that often, that it seems like one thing's right after another, but maybe a few years has elapsed in that. Same thing here. Okay, that's the setting of the book of Esther. The structure or notes about the book is also interesting before we look at the context. Let me just ask a quick question, raise of hands. How many of you feel like you're pretty familiar with the plot of Esther? Raise your hand. Okay, good. I'll be brief then on the plot, because most of you say you're pretty familiar with it. We'll be brief on it. This is the big picture. For those that don't know, the big picture plot of Esther. Esther is a Jewish girl living in captivity with her uncle Mordecai. The king, being the drunk that he is, apparently, gets displeased with his lead wife. Don't think it's his only wife. There's a harem involved here. But his lead wife, he gets displeased with her. so, and there is this rash decision that the fact that his lead wife stands up to him, it's going to lead to this overall rebellion in all of Persia. All the women are going to start standing up to their husbands. So there's a decree. Let her be, you know, completely removed, dismissed, never to see the king again. And that happens, so now he needs to look for a new wife. Mordecai, this Jew living in captivity, sees this as an opportunity to get some clout in court. And so it is encouraged, he encourages Esther, this his niece, to kind of get her lot thrown in the pool of the new queen. It's about a year time lapse where she needs to be proved as new queen. So they do beauty treatments and court etiquette and all this sort of stuff for months and months and months. And then the king, she's put in a harem, held by eunuchs so that there's no concerns about anything miss going on. And each woman in the harem is brought for one night of immorality, the king's adultery, his fornication with the woman. And then after that, if he doesn't care for her, she's sent, this is not a very nice story, okay? If he doesn't like her, she is sent to another harem where she'll never be married or have anyone else, any sort of sexual relationship with anybody else the rest of her life. So all these women are being brought into this scenario. The king likes Esther and seeks to make her his queen. That's the kind of the bottom line of that scenario. Of course, then the story shifts and there's a bad guy that's kind of in the story, the way it's kind of written. It's the kind of thing where it's like live theater where you're supposed to boo every time you hear his name. It's that sort of like, it's like presented that way, you know, with Haman. And it's like, he just always is like, the picture you get from the story is like, he's just a bad guy. And he and Mordecai have some sort of beef. Mordecai won't give him the honor that Haman deserves. He's prime minister. He won't give him that sort of honor. We have no idea in the Bible why he won't give him that honor. We have no, nothing doesn't say anywhere. Could be that he knew that Haman was a Jew hater. It could be that, we just don't know. It's just that part's left out. But there's this beef there and Haman hates and burns with hatred toward Mordecai. He doesn't know that Mordecai and Esther are related. And what happens along the way is he comes up with this great idea because he wants to be higher and higher and higher of, and when he gets to the place where he thinks that he's the highest he can be, he comes up with a plot to kill the Jews. Not just the Jews in the area, but it says in the text, in every satrap or every area where there is Persian rule, that Jews are to be exterminated, is the idea, the kind of decree that Haman does. And of course, the king approves of such because he's drunk. And so he approves of that sort of thing. And so what happens is Haman's got it. He's figured it out. He's going to become great. And Mordecai, who he knows is a Jew, he and all the Jews are going to be destroyed. Well, Mordecai goes to Esther and he says, do you know what's going on? Well, it's kind of a convoluted way in which he does that. But he goes to Esther, or she calls him in because he's mourning in front of the gate and she's embarrassed for her uncle. And she calls him in. He says, I can't, how can I, you know, you were Jews. And a lot of people think, well, Esther is like this, like, okay, I'm going to go do something about this. But she actually doesn't want to do anything about it because she's scared to death, understandably. But Mordecai tells her, you're a Jew. What makes you think just because you're the queen, when the edict comes to kill the Jews, that you won't be killed as well? And she says, okay, yeah, it makes sense. We got to do something. And then this remarkable courage that she shows, because she can't go in to see the king unless he invites her in. As you can see, he's got a pretty particular way of handling women, right? And so this famous part of the book of Esther, if you know the book of Esther, you probably know this part of it, where when it's determined that she is going to go in to see the king, even if it means she loses her life because she's not been invited, she says, and if I perish, I perish. That famous line, you know, the courage and the boldness. So she does. The king appreciates her and he welcomes her in, and she then asks him to come to a banquet. And so there's two banquets that take place, and Haman and the king are the only two invited to the queen's banquet. So this causes the banquet of wine is what it's called. So this causes Haman to really get pretty proud of his accomplishments. He obviously, you've got to be somebody if you, the king, and the queen get private dinner together. And so he's excited. So now he's, by the way, a Hebrew word for lots or casting lots is the word pur. And so he throws his purr. He casts his dice. He kind of gambles. He goes all in. And so he's like, this is it. We're gonna come down. I build the gallows for Mordecai because he's gone tomorrow. We've done it. I'm of the favor of the king and queen. Well, on the second banquet, the queen lets out this idea that there's somebody here that wants to kill me. And the king's like, who would want to kill my queen? I'll kill him, you know? And she says, it's Haman. I'm a Jew. He wants to kill Jews. And so, of course, everything in the story starts unraveling the other way. Haman now is put to death. Another edict is given. Mordecai, in the kind of the middle of it, Mordecai is exalted by some weird, strange circumstances. Mordecai's suddenly exalted. And in the end, the Jews are allowed to fight for their lives with a second edict. Mordecai becomes the prime minister instead of Haman. And that's where the story ends. Now, I say that's where the story ends because that's exactly where it ends. However, apocryphal books add chapters to the book of Esther and add things to it. Very clearly, they're apocryphal, but there's just if you read in the Catholic Bible, they include them. For example, if you ever pick up a Catholic Bible or a Catholic website, it would have all sorts of things that aren't in this book here. So that's the big picture. That's the plot of Esther. Strange story indeed. The structure is interesting. The structure does just exactly as I said. It kind of starts with the king's greatness. Xerxes, it's kind of like a chiasm, right? Xerxes' greatness and Mordecai and Esther's lot that they cast to try to, the lot means like the dice. And the idea there, everyone's taking their chance in this book. You got one chance to get it, and you just roll the dice and go for it and see what happens. And that's constantly what you see through this. That's going to matter because have you ever heard of the Feast of Purim, the Hebrew Feast of Purim? That's a celebration of the book of Esther that the Jews celebrate today, the Feast of Lots, casting the dice, because the dice, and it just so happened that when the Jews cast their lots, it worked out to their advantage, and when Haman cast his lot, it didn't work out for him. It's kind of the picture. I'm going to bring something up in just a minute. Let me finish kind of the structure, though. Xerxes' greatness and Mordecai and Esther's lot. Haman's rise to power in chapter 3. Haman's decree to kill the Jews in chapter 3. Esther and Mordecai's efforts to save the people. Then Esther's banquet. And right in the middle of the book, or really middle of the structure, Mordecai is strangely honored through a really strange circumstance, where the king can't sleep at night. And he's like, I need to get to sleep. Have them bring some old history scrolls for me to read through. So he gets the old history books out, the history scrolls, they start reading these to him. And it comes out that there was a long time before, there was this plot to kill the king that was thwarted by Mordecai. And the king goes, whoa, when did this happen? And they say, oh, it was such and such. And he says, we should honor Mordecai for that. So in the middle of the night, because he's got insomnia and he can't sleep and he's reading the history scrolls, he decides to exalt Mordecai. So the next morning he calls in Haman. Haman just so happens to be outside the door, ready to come in to say, hey, we're going to kill Mordecai. And the king says, oh, Haman, he's my prime minister. He's a wise man. Come in. What would you do for the man that needs to be greatly honored? And Haman's like, well, who could he be talking about except for me? Well, I'd have him ride the king's donkey, and I'd have him put on the king's robe and the king's crown, and be paraded through the city. And the king goes, that's a really good idea. He's always impressionable, it seems like this king is. Why don't you go make sure that gets done to Mordecai? Of course, Haman just is blown away. This happens right between Esther's banquet, first day, and second day. And that's the middle structure of the book. Then that's when everything begins to unravel, because then the chiasm kind of goes back the other way. Now we have Esther's second banquet, which corresponds with her first, where she blames Haman, right? Then Esther and Mordecai's efforts to save their people again. The first was their effort in getting Esther into the court. The second now is their effort in getting the king to get a new degree. Then Mordecai's decree to save the Jews, which corresponds with Haman's decree to kill the Jews in the structure. Then Mordecai's rise to power, which corresponds with Haman's rise to power. And then finally, it ends up with chapter 10 ends with the greatness of Mordecai in contrast to the greatness of the Persian king Xerxes. So there's this kind of chiastic structure, and right in the middle is that weird, strange, coincidental event where the king can't sleep. It's kind of a strange structure for a book of the Bible, right? This is one of the most enigmatic, strange, not strange as in unreasonable things, because it's actually quite a natural kind of story you might read anywhere else in any history book. Plots to kill the king and queens and all that sort of stuff. What's strange about it is that it doesn't really seem to have theological, spiritual, covenantal purpose. It's a really interesting, fun story. To take that a little bit further, in the book of Esther, not the Catholic apocryphal accounts, but in the book of Esther, there is not one reference to God. There is not one reference to Jehovah. There is not one reference to the Torah, the law. There is not one reference to promises, covenants. There is not one reference to Abraham. There is not one reference to David. There is not a reference to any of the other theological covenantal words or things found in nearly every other book of the Bible. There are theories that the book of Esther somehow in the Hebrew has a sort of like acrostic of Jehovah or different things like that. But if you just read it at its face value, it's not really, God's not there. Now, this is important because what then is the theme? How do we know? So we can know what the theme of some things are because it's simpler, it's simple to find. But what's the theme of Esther? What's the point of the book? That's a really big question. Now, I mean, I'm just going to throw this out, but I want to see if you can answer this. But don't answer with just normal Christianese. Like if you were just reading it for the first time, pretend that. Pretend you don't know the rest of the Bible, okay? What's the theme of the book of Esther? You got to pretend you don't know the rest of the Bible. It's hard. Okay, the preservation of a people on the verge of genocide, right? Or you can put it this way, the deliverance of a people, deliverance of an ethnic group in captivity, the deliverance of people, of a people group. Now we know who the people group are. Now we can add our knowledge of the rest of the Bible in. So we could change that to the deliverance of God's people, right? These are God's people. The deliverance of God's people. Who delivers God's people? So here's the interesting way to look at it. The story presents nearly every character named as a deliverer of sorts. Okay, let's just start with the people. So the first person that I mentioned is the person Vashti. She's, some of these are a reach, but you'll see when I get to the end why we're reaching here. Vashti, she's the queen. She's the one when her husband, Xerxes, is in, he's filling the wine flow freely. He says, bring out my wife so she may show everybody her beauty. She refuses. We have no idea why she refuses. It's speculation to say because what he was doing was an immoral act or a moral act. It just doesn't describe it that way. For some reason, she refuses. Her refusal sets everything in motion. And I know this is a what if, but I just want you to play the game with me. Because I think that's this book invites us to this. I believe the Spirit is inviting us into this. It's kind of like how Pastor Kids, when talking about Ecclesiastes, invites us to not just jump to the conclusion, but kind of like think through life. Without Vashti's refusal, Esther does not become queen. The Jews are destroyed. Her refusal. She's a deliverer of God's people. But she's incidental, right? But it's kind of like, yeah, she does. I get that, you know, if she doesn't refuse, if she doesn't stand up to the king, none of this happens. But you could say that about anything. True. Okay. So we'll just put her kind of like, she's a quasi involved in the deliverance of God's people, right? Xerxes, he delivers God. He's the one that issues the edict that says that they get to defend themselves from their attackers. They have the right to own weapons. He's a deliverer, right, of God's people. But why does he issue that edict? Who issued the first edict to kill all the Jews? He did. Haman comes to him, right? He has to have the king issue the edict. The prime minister gives, but he's fixing a problem he created. That's a sort of deliverance, and that's kind of in our world today, in our culture today, that's like typical politician deliverance, right? You fix, yeah, I've got a problem, I've got a fix for the problem I caused. But that's the sort of deliverer he is. He's a deliverer who issues an important edict, but it's because he created the problem for the edict needing to be issued in the first place. So he's sort of there. Can we even say that Haman is a deliverer in this setting? Well, mostly not, but who built the gallows that Haman was killed on? He built his own gallows, which some Hebrew scholars think that this actually means stake. In the Hebrew word, it just means basically gallows is a word, but it just means wood is all it means in the Hebrew. So something being impaled on a stake was a common Persian form of punishment. So that's what that means, in impaling. But regardless of that, his own arrogance and pride, his push for power, and built even to the point of building the own mechanism that kills himself, the greatest enemy. So in a kind of a perverse way, he delivers the people by creating the scenario for him to be killed. So that's sort of like a deliverance in the scenario, but not fully. But now we're getting to a little bit, now we're moving kind of past those more enigmatic ones and kind of moving a little bit closer. So the Jews, the people, they're mentioned here, the Jewish people, they are allowed under the second edict to take up swords and weapons and to fight against. In a sense, you could say they delivered themselves, right? They killed their enemies who attacked them. That's not an uncommon way for us to think of deliverance, right? If a individual was killing my family and I take personal defense weapons and I kill that intruder who's killing my family, I think the world would say, I saved my family, right? But they only do so at the king's edict. They only do so because the law allows them to. So that's not a full deliverance either. But now we get to the last two, the main two characters in the book, right? They probably more than any are seen as the deliverers of God's people. Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai, how does he deliver God's people? Well, his cunning politics. Right? His loyalty to the king. You know, if he had not saved the king years before, then he would not have been given the authority that very moment, because we know the king was impressionable in this way, that very moment when the king couldn't sleep and he comes into the room. If Mordecai had not read in the account of Mordecai saving the king, then it all would have been a different story, right? So Mordecai's actions, even prior to this particular thing, his actions in thwarting the plot to kill the king earlier. Mordecai and his wisdom in how he approaches, you know, Esther, and don't say who you are. Don't reveal you're a Jew. You know, raising her, all these sorts of things. He's kind of like, he kind of fits the story, biblically speaking, kind of like in the same vein as one of the judges. Flawed, but victorious, right? Got some faults. For example, let's just not hide from the fact that who puts their niece in a situation to be in the king's harem, right? Who does that? I don't think that's the right thing to do. That's definitely opposed to Jewish Torah, Jewish law. But, you know, he seems to be, on the other hand, the story portrays him as a very honorable man. Kind of like I said, kind of like one of those judges in the Old Testament, in the judge book of Judges, like Samson. Like, he's a hero, but then it's him and you're like, oh, you got some serious things that make me cringe. So Mordecai, I think, is one of the individuals here. And really, the story has more about Mordecai's deliverance than Esther's deliverance. It's more because there's that contrast of Mordecai saving the king. Mordecai being is the one who told Esther to do this. Mordecai is the one who she gets advice from. Mordecai is the one who convinces her to go into the king, even if it's going to cost their life. Mordecai is the one who becomes the prime minister and at the end is exalted and great. So he is he's described as a great, he's a great individual in Jewish history in the book. A lot of Jewish people throughout history have been named Mordecai. It's a very, very honorable name to be called Mordecai. He saves his people. I'll come back to him in a minute because I want to just talk about Esther and then come back to Mordecai. Esther, she clearly is a deliverer of God's people, right? It's her courage to go in, if I perish, I perish, that saves the people, that turns the big turning of the story happens in Esther's, because of Esther's courage to go to the king and request a banquet. That's the middle, that's the turning of the story. Her courage, her bravery, her boldness. And yet there's a way in which you could say, but just like with actually the other characters, she was sort of a victim of her circumstances, right? From being chosen in the king's harem to happening to be a Jew. She did the least of everyone in the story. She, if you think about it, she, I'm talking about inactivity level. She has a banquet and says, Haman's trying to kill me and the people. That's the equivalent of her, like, major thing she did. Now, I'm not undermining her courage, but she doesn't really do a lot, right? She's not even nearly as cunning as either Mordecai or Haman. She's not nearly as involved in the politics of it as Mordecai and Haman are. So this kind of small activity, but playing probably the biggest part in the whole story, is how we look at Esther. Now, I want to go back to Mordecai for just a minute, because this book of Esther has one of the biggest ironies in all of the Bible. Who is Mordecai? Look at Esther chapter 1. And I knew for the time's sake we weren't going to be able to read various passages in Esther today. I encourage you to read this on your own. If I was doing a 2 or 3 part series, we would have spent more time doing this. Actually, chapter 1. This is where Mordecai is introduced. In Shushan 2:5. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Any names in there ring a bell? Kish? Shimei? Yeah, Shimei was the name of the guy that, and I don't know if it's the exact same guy or a descendant of, but the name, because this isn't giving his entire lineage here. It's just giving, I think it's just giving notable names, not necessarily even just notable names in that lineage. Shimei is the one that was cursing David after David was king. The same person, same name at least, of the individual, perhaps a namesake or perhaps the guy, I don't know. But was cursing David, and David said, let him curse. And why was Shimei cursing David?
He was leaving the city of Jerusalem after the overthrow.
Right, under Absalom's deposing him. But why? What would motivate Shimei to be so angry at David?
Because he was a son of Saul.
He was a descendant of Saul. Mordecai is a direct descendant of Saul, the first king, right? Saul, that line, is the perpetual enemy of David's line, right? That's why Shimei in that line is still cursing. Okay, this is the big irony. Mordecai's actions, so at first when you read this, when you read Esther, you're like, well, yeah, these are the people who stayed behind. These are the people who didn't go back into Jerusalem to build the temple and the city. This Zerubbabel, that's a descendant of David. Okay, Zerubbabel is a descendant of David. He's back. David's line, the Messiah's line, is back in Jerusalem rebuilding the Messiah's city, the city of David, right? These, for lack of better words, losers, are still in Babylon, finding a way to get in to the harem of the king with his niece. People that, as far as I can tell, you never have any instance of them praying. I mean, the closest you get is it says they'll fast. They fasted. Perhaps prayer is involved in that. But you don't get the picture that these are the devout line of David. And yet in the weirdest, ironic twist, it is Saul's descendant Mordecai, who actually saves David's descendant, Zerubbabel. Why? Because remember, the edict to kill the Jews went where? Throughout the whole empire, which includes the Jews back in Jerusalem building the walls. They had no idea what was going on back in Persia. These people aren't mentioned anywhere in the books except for here, right? And yet, God uses an enemy of David's, Saul's descendants, to actually be the very ones, human means, to preserve the line of David, aka the line of the Messiah, aka Christ. What? This is the biggest irony in the Bible, I think. The biggest, switch, turn of events. We thought we were done with Saul. We thought we were done with Saul after all that business. But here, after in the captivity, we find Saul's descendants show up again. Now, I'm out of time. So we have to give the final point. So who saved? Who really delivered God's people? The book of Esther invites us in a journey. It invites us in a journey to ask the question that many of us ask in our lives, where is God? Where is God when? Where is God when this? Where was God? You know, the book of Esther, the author of the book of Esther wants us to ask that question. That's why I think God is left out of the story completely. He wants us to ask, where is God? And yet, everywhere, who's doing all of these things? Who's really delivering God's people? I mean, who's giving the king insomnia in the middle of the night to read a history book from an event that took place many years before from a Jew who was in captivity, who didn't really know what he was doing? There are so many crazy, in this story, crazy coincidences from a human perspective. Just crazy coincidences. Things that don't, wow, that lot, that purr really lined up well. You just rolled snake eyes or whatever it is. I don't know. You just rolled the dice and it just whoa. You know, if you like to play cards, you got the flush. You know what the chances of that happening is? That's the idea here. You got the royal flush. What are the chances of that happening? What are the chances of Esther all working as it does? It's so uncanny. One who reads the story through the lens of faith says, the chances are so slim. There's only one reason why all these things lined up so perfectly to preserve a people thousands of miles away, so to preserve a lineage hundreds of years later. There's only one way that lines up. the silent sovereignty of God. The silent sovereignty of God. The word we use to describe silent sovereignty is the word providence. Meaning God at work in a thousand ways. And we, as humans, think, like Esther did, well, I guess it's on me now. And Mordecai, here's what you got to do. Here's the way we got to work this out. And Haman, here's how I can make myself better. And Xerxes, have another glass of wine. You know, all we're doing all these things, and God is doing things 10 times better, more effective, in a way that fulfills his sovereign, theological, soteriological purposes. So this story is about the deliverance of God's people, but it's about the silent sovereignty of the God who delivers. And if God is silent but sovereign in the book of Esther, then look through your life, look through your week, and believe in the silent sovereignty of God. He is just as active, just as much at work in all the things happening in your life, because he has not changed since the book of Esther. So we're out of time. I wish there was more that we could look at. I wish we could read. I had all kinds of passages written down to read to kind of see all this out, but you're going to have to do that on your own since we're out of time. But Esther, fascinating book. Spend some time in it and trust and believe and grow and lean into the silent sovereignty of God. Let's pray.